Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today was one of the speakers for the Fulbright Scholar Seminar being held in Tulsa on the Old to New West, the role of land in shaping the American story. And my guest today, along with her husband, envisioned one of the biggest reshapings of the West since the plow first broke the plains. Back in 1987, geographers Frank and Deborah Popper first proposed the Buffalo Commons, a conceptual proposal to create a vast nature preserve in the driest areas of the Great Plains, the shortgrass prairies. The idea was to turn as much as 139,000 square miles from Montana to the Texas Panhandle back to its pre-settlement state with bison and wildlife, in essence, an American Serengeti. The Poppers cited the declining population of the area along with a lack of sustainability for agriculture in this driest area of the High Plains. As one might expect, reaction to this idea met with considerable resistance and protest, and the Poppers were routinely vilified. But interestingly, the Poppers have continued to meet with residents over the years, explain their ideas, and interestingly, population has continued to decline, and even more questions about the sustainability of the current land use are arising, leading to a remarkable turnabout, at least in some quarters, about the Buffalo Commons. To be sure, resistance remains, but a number of demonstrations, from Oklahoma's Tallgrass Prairie to Ted Turner's bison ranches to a number of experiments on Indian tribal lands, have caused some to take a second look at this concept. My guest today is Deborah Popper. She's a professor of geography and a faculty fellow at the College of Staten Island, associated with the City University of New York. She joins us today by phone on Studio Tulsa. Deborah Popper, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure to be joining you and looking forward to being in Tulsa.
Take us back to 1987 when you and Frank Popper first proposed the Buffalo Commons, which is this idea of this huge park, if you will, or a huge Serengeti-like plain, reverting the Great Plains to the way it was prior to man fencing it off and using the plow. First of all, I've heard two different stories. One, that this was a footnote to an article about the basic depopulation of the Great Plains, and then I've seen other documents that this was a full-blown idea from the beginning. How did the idea get started?
Well, it now is a long time ago. 1987 really is a long time back. And what happened, I think, at the time is Frank had been working on some projects, thinking about low-density places. Frontier was one of the things that he had been doing a paper on and doing research on, and sort of trying to figure out how to narrow down his concentration from the whole of the West to a sub-region within the West. And decided Great Plains looked pretty interesting. So off the whole family trotted to go wander around the Great Plains for a while. And as we were doing that, thinking about what does it mean to be in this part of the country? What does it mean to live here? What are the pressures upon people who are living in places where density is so low and where population was dropping? You know, rural Great Plains was losing population. And we did that in 1985, actually, and then came back and tossed around a lot of different ideas about what we saw, what we thought it meant, what it might mean for the future, and wrote an article for a planner, city planning, urban planning, land use planning audience, in which we really did focus on the booms and busts of the Great Plains, and then think about, is there a way of getting around the booms and busts? And tossed out the notion of the Buffalo Commons, a term that we had come up with as we were trying to define that future, trying to figure out how to capture it quickly. So I can't say it was a full-blown idea. It was a full-blown sort of imagined idea. Okay, you keep losing population. What does that look like if you keep losing population in rural areas that are already pretty light on the ground? Well, maybe it brings back some of the past to that place. Perhaps there is more mobility of animals. Maybe the hard work of turning over the grasses and putting in new crops every year reverts to, you know, you revert to some of those older grasses. Maybe you think about some of those old, the animals that had been really, whose numbers had gone down so much. And so that Buffalo Commons as an idea where you're visualizing those herds wandering about that plain. How does, you know, what does that do? How does it change the way you think? So I think we had no concept at that time that anybody would read the article or take it seriously. It was in many ways a thought experiment that then triggered lots of talk and experiments as well, you know, on the ground. So I think that's where it started.
Well, I remember lots of controversy, too. I mean, the idea that people say in western Nebraska, western Kansas, eastern Colorado, western Oklahoma, the Texas Panhandle, would turn this very commercial agricultural and energy commodity location back to, you know, nature was tremendously controversial. And the thing that struck me was that when you first proposed this in 1987, you have to remember the two, I would say, tent poles of the economy of this area were in horrible shape. Energy, for one, energy prices had plummeted in the early 80s, and you had a whole wave of bankruptcies and bank failures in this region of the country because of low energy prices. Agricultural prices were also in the dumper as well, commodity prices. This seemed like a very prescient idea. Now both of those have rebounded, but yet when you look at this area, population is still declining. It's still aging. Anytime you drive through these areas, places that were a small town or village become even less so on every trip through. That depopulation is continuing on the high plains.
Right. I think that one of the reasons people squealed so much when we wrote this was, A, they thought we had power, and of course we had zero power to make any of it happen personally. You know, you had, I mean, I was a graduate student at the time, and Frank was a professor, and quite frankly, those are not the two most powerful positions that you can imagine. But, you know, there was that sense of, ooh, those Easterners are doing this to us. And secondly, there was a lot of pain. And so it was as though we were poking people and saying, ooh, you know, things are tough, aren't they? Ugh. And so there was a bit of fear as to what was going to happen and what was happening to their communities. What could they do? And so I think you had those kinds of things, which at some level made for more discussion of the idea. I think if people had just sort of shrugged and said, yeah, sure, nobody would have paid any attention whatsoever. The other kinds of things that were happening, which also influenced it, was not only that the economy was tough, but that some of the environmental issues were becoming more and more glaring. You know, you had pretty high drought years at that point, certainly in the northern plains. And so what does that mean? We don't want any droughts. And you had the sort of ways in which over time the pests were getting smarter and smarter and outsmarting, you know, all these people, putting more insecticide out there. So the optimism of we can conquer everything seemed to be a little, you know, it's a little shaky. And so, again, that led to people saying, of course we can manage this and go away, but also a tremendous interest in discussing how to manage it. And I've always said we were very useful. We had lots of wonderful invitations where people would try to educate us, but they were also using us strategically so that they could, you know, they bring us in, everybody could agree on one thing, which is they didn't like us, and now they could talk about what they wanted to do. Okay. Yeah.
A punching bag, basically, to unite their audiences. Yeah.
That's right. Because, in fact, you know, as you think about it, not all those interests are identical. The wheat interest, the cattle interest, the energy interests aren't identical. They don't necessarily see the world the same way or want the same things out of the markets, out of the federal government. But indeed, they now knew somebody that was, you know, that they disliked more, and it was Frank and me. And we could leave at the end of their, you know, they're politely looking at us and saying, thank you, but go away. Okay, we'll go home.
Well, when did that perception begin to change? Because you and Frank have both interacted with the High Plains since you wrote that paper, sometimes as whipping boys, so to speak. But you've continued that interaction, and this idea is starting to take hold in places like North Dakota and Kansas. At times, there was, you know, a governor that actually was talking about a High Plains National Park, which would have been heresy. You know, I mean, that would have been immediate grounds for impeachment.
Absolutely. I think it changed in the 90s. And don't worry, we can still trigger some kind of hostility. I'm sure I can do it personally. But it changed in the 90s, I think, for a number of reasons. One was, I think, that it did become clear we didn't have the power to do it. So that, in fact, we weren't quite so threatening. And that there was that desire to think things through on the part of lots and lots of people. This, you know, it's an area of the country where, indeed, people feel tremendous allegiance to their own place and do want to figure out how to make things work. So, you know, lots and lots of groups would bring us in. And as they brought us in, I think they realized, oh, okay, not only did we not have the power, but we weren't quite as villainous as we might have seemed from never having had contact with us. So I think it was in that interaction and then an acknowledgement that, indeed, maybe things have to change. As I said, I think some of the environmental issues, some of the economic issues sort of pushed towards, okay, well, you know, let's do something differently. You know, I can't remember what year it was. Frank is always better on numbers than I am. But we did go out to North Dakota one year for what was just a fabulous occasion. One of the towns in North Dakota did a play, and this was a melodrama in which Frank and I were the villains and villainesses. Frank was this professor who was coming through and trying to steal all the water from everybody. And I was his wife and a floozy. And you know, people would hiss. You know, the characters on stage who were standing in for us, of course. And it was just hilarious. You know, we went through the town, through the parade, in a manure spreader. You know, it was just absolutely classic. Gwinner, North Dakota did this. You know, sort of, okay, we can take this and play with it now. We're not so threatened, and we can use it in a variety of ways to think about change and what it means. So you've got that as one piece. You alluded to Mike Hayden, the Kansas governor, you know, sort of early on said, oh, what an insult. You know, this is terrible. But then subsequently, indeed, has very, very much said, this is, you know, I was wrong. And in fact, again, we were out in Manhattan, Kansas, when in front of a very large crowd, he stood up there and said, I was wrong. Very brave thing for a politician to do. And that, indeed, we need more public land here, and we need to take more care of our public land and of our land. And, you know, sort of looked at his own history, his own family, his own community, and said, you know, when I was growing up, it was vibrant, and then it becomes threatened when those numbers drop too much. You can't maintain the community in the same way, and we have to start thinking differently. So in Kansas, or some people in Kansas have certainly embraced the idea, but I wouldn't say all of Kansas is thrilled with it still. it's still controversial in its own way.
My guest today is Deborah Popper, a professor of geography and faculty fellow at the College of Staten Island, part of the City University of New York. And she's one of the scholars for the Fulbright seminar, Old to New West, the role of land in shaping the American story. She and her husband, Frank, came up with the Buffalo Commons idea in 1987, which envisioned a large federalization of a good part of the Great Plains and return of buffalo in a sort of migratory patterns, like in the 1800s. Now, I will say that the one thing that you have both admitted that you got wrong was the idea of the federal government coming in. But what's really been interesting is these big projects that have been going on in various locations in the high plains, from the Tallgrass Prairie in Oklahoma, the Nature Conservancy, to Ted Turner out in Montana, to a number of Indian tribes that have sort of reinstated common lands and returned bison to a lot of those. Again, these are patchwork projects. Do you see that sort of encompassing with some of the more successful enclaves in the high plains? Because one of the things that is still going on is energy is still going to be a very viable industry in this location, probably for at least another 50 years, I would think. Does that change the equation at all?
It clearly does, insofar as it gives people different incentives. When things are tough, people were sitting there thinking, oh my God, we have to do something different. If they're more comfortable, particularly if they're financially more comfortable, then they're less likely to say we need to do something different. But in some ways, of course, it's as important to continue to think of what you're doing with the land. And I say this as somebody who lives in the New York metro area, that development doesn't necessarily make for better living, you know, nor does income necessarily make everybody's life all that great. You know, it's horrible not to have an income, but, you know, you need to think through how you're using your land and how you're using your resources so that, in fact, they remain desirable over the long term. So if, in fact, you're creating air pollution, you know, air quality conditions and water quality conditions, and you're losing your water because it's going to energy, which may be going to some other part of the country, you know, I'm not sure that that's a good outcome for you. In fact, it may be okay today, but if you still want to be there 10 years and 20 years and 50 years from now, you might want to think through what you want to set aside. What are those areas that you want to make sure you're treating well? You know, what you're doing with your water. I mean, so to me, it's at least as important to think about a Buffalo Commons now. It may indeed be that you're looking at how that patchwork can work together to provide livelihoods and how a Buffalo Commons can provide livelihoods. It's not just that resource extraction does, but how that those other things do so, and how do they work together? Or do you, in fact, want to say, some of these high extractive industries maybe could be restrained a little bit?
The tensions on this area have not changed over the last 40 years. You mentioned water. Water continues to be the big issue for the West. It was the big issue in the settlement of the West. It was the big issue of how the West actually developed. You know, remember, before World War II and the big water projects, a lot of the West was sparsely populated. And you see all the demands for water. You look at a lot of surface lakes in the High Plains area. Some of them are gone or nearly gone. You have the Ogallala Aquifer, which from every bit of research I see is still being depleted. This is not going to go away for these communities that depend on water for agriculture as well as just for their community.
Right. John Opie, historian, did a very interesting book. This would have been back in the 90s. Which looked specifically at the Oklahoma Panhandle, if I remember correctly, and which interviewing lots of families out there about their water use, and of course, what you had was the ability to sort of see the changes that had taken place when center pivot irrigation came in. And you had cheap energy, was whoopee, now we can make this predictable and we can up our production, and isn't that great? And then the first thing that hit them was, oh my goodness, energy prices are going up. Now water starts to look a little bit iffier. You know, we're not recovering our costs, and so now we need to be a little bit more careful. And then, of course, the realization that not only are we paying too much for what we're using, but it's got a short lifespan. So if we're going to keep spewing it out in the same way and asking families, well, what are you going to do? And some of them saying, well, we'll use it up and then we'll move on. And others of them saying, oh, we're really trying to make changes, and other, you know, and in this time since, you know, since the early 90s, you know, there have been some changes, certainly. There is a reduction. People are more able to use all sorts of information technology to reduce their use to, you know, to irrigate more sensibly. But still, indeed, you're right that there are places that are that have lost their water, and everything has to change in the way that you do your practices. You know, it's ongoing, but then also the different policies. You know, you've got support for ethanol, which said, okay, if you can find the water, grow corn, which is more water intensive, and so some areas that probably should never have corn, growing corn. You know, so each one of those, like, here's a new incentive. Let's, you know, okay, we're going to respond. You know, an awful lot of energy extract. You know, the energy extraction in the Dakotas. You know, with that, you're using water. What are you going to do? So it is a limit, and yet it's very hard to face it.
My guest today is Deborah Proper, a professor of geography and faculty fellow at the College of Staten Island, a part of the City University of New York. She's one of the scholars for the Fulbright Seminar, Old to New West, The Role of Land in Shaping the American Story. And she and her husband, Frank Proper, proposed the Buffalo Commons back in 1987, and widely reviled at the time by citizens of the High Plains. There's now some new efforts to incorporate at least a portion of that vision into the planning of a lot of these communities, because one of the things that's happening is the depopulation of a good part of the High Plains is continuing. Now, certainly there are cities that are going to withstand that, and towns that have that sort of ability to with institutions like colleges and things that are going to withstand that pressure. I was reading an encyclopedia entry. It was a High Plains encyclopedia entry about the Buffalo Commons, and the writer had sort of a negative view of your work, and I was interested by what he said was going to save the High Plains, and it was the social institutions, the churches, the civic groups, and the sort of sense of community in a lot of these small towns. But what I've seen in a lot of the High Plains, for every town that has one of those, there's another town that doesn't, and it is utterly just drying up. So this depopulation continues. The young people leave town. The population continues to age. And at some point, it seems to me that a lot of these little towns and the little hamlets, as agricultural operations get larger and there's less of a social reason to have that little small town, a lot of these towns are going to die out. Is that your sense?
Sure. That's certainly a tragedy of sorts, that these places, they just can't keep their churches if the numbers drop that much. All of these kind of social institutions are labor intensive, and that's what they're counting on. They're counting on all the people to do all of the things to support each other, but you can't do everything. And so when you're getting, you know, when you're getting down to smaller and smaller numbers, then it's the same people over and over and over again. And so you can't, and they can't pay the taxes or whatever. All of that, it is tremendous stress. You can't keep the little markets going, because after all, who's gonna buy? So it becomes a question of which ones will survive, and that actually again creates a sort of antagonism between communities. Well, why are you getting to keep the consolidated school instead of me? Why are you getting to keep the church? That fear of my town's going to be the loser. So indeed, that is a problem. I guess it's a question of, is there something that would bring people back? A few places are going to be able to come up with a reason to attract, because that's actually what you're talking about. At some level, these are places where they didn't keep attracting new people. The reason that population growth has occurred in a lot of the rest of the country, where it has occurred in a lot of the rest of the country, actually is not from the people who were born there. having umpteen children, and therefore, you know, the population goes up, it's been bringing people in from elsewhere, often bringing them in from other countries. So a lot of the rural plains did not become one of those areas where new people came. And as the opportunities for young people decreased, you know, what jobs were they going to take? And maybe they even wanted to leave, you know, for a while because, after all, they'd already dated everybody they had thought possible to date. You know, oh, please let me date somebody I didn't know from age three. So, you know, that sort of sense of let me go elsewhere. That thinning of the social, sort of social infrastructure and social structure, and without the newcomers, made them tougher and tougher places to be in. So, okay, can that be reversed? It's tough. That's very tough to reverse.
Yeah, I was struck by something you said, which is even the small towns that have attracted newcomers, a lot of times it is a socially diverse population that is coming in. In fact, ethnically diverse. And that causes tensions of its own in a lot of these small towns.
Yeah, it does. And, it's fascinating to see that. Of course, one of the things also is that people who have been there, we'll say my grandfather, my great great grandfather came and homesteaded, and I've been here forever. But of course, they were new then. When the great great grandfather came, there were a lot of new people coming to the neighborhood, and the relationships were certainly uncomfortable then. Now so that sense of it's always been mine is a little off. Certainly, it hasn't always been yours, but that need, to acknowledge and welcome the newcomers, I think probably will increase over time. That the newcomers will eventually themselves be not such newcomers, and that will, I think, probably be a bit of revitalization for the area. But it's acknowledging change that was not seen as what they were looking at, as many of the communities were looking. That wasn't the change they had in mind.
Yes.
It was that it should all be sort of how they remembered it a generation earlier, which probably wasn't the way it was then. Just as, we all look back and remember this glorious era that, which never existed quite the way we were, with our little rosy glasses.
All right. Well, Deborah Popper, I appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Geographer Deborah Popper speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She and her husband Frank are the proponents and originators of the idea of the Buffalo Commons. She's one of the scholars addressing the Fulbright Seminar on the Old to New West this week here in Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.